Welcome to Proclaiming Christ. This is episode number 58, Genesis 19, 1 through 11, a supernatural rescue mission. At Proclaiming Christ, we seek to encourage, discuss, and provide resources for preachers, teachers, and students of the Bible. My name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee. And along with me today to interact on this passage from Genesis 19 is our brother Glenn Clary, pastor at Providence Presbyterian Church in Pflugerville, Texas. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Mark.
Thank you very much for being with us today. And also Adam York, pastor of Providence Presbyterian Church in Kingwood, Texas.
Well, hi there. Seems like I was just with you guys.
It wasn't all that long ago, was it? And we're going to roll right along into Genesis chapter 19 on the heels of, and I'd encourage our listeners to go back and listen to Adam's discussion of the last part of Genesis 18, if you haven't done that already. But as Adam did with the last half of chapter 18, let me begin by reading in Genesis 19, verses 1 through 11. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, and then you may rise up early and go your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the town square." But he pressed them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called out to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance and shut the door after him and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn, and he's become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." And they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out for groping the door. This is a horrific scene that, if you're reading through Genesis, it follows on the joyous scene of chapter 18 in God's covenant meal, the warning that God is going to go down to Sodom. And the last half of the chapter now comes to fruition. And in preaching this chapter, of course, I've just read the first portion of it. There are 38 verses in all. I kind of divide it into three sections. I think you see first this example of immorality, and then second, the judgment that comes upon them, and then third, the incident with Lot's daughters. Just looking at this first section, one of the things that I think it's important to draw out in preaching or teaching this passage are the numerous parallels that exist between the story here and the story that we just read in chapter 18. It's a visitation of God's representatives, where we see a theophany, I think, in chapter 18. Here we see the angels coming as representatives of God to Sodom, finishing their investigative work that has begun in chapter 18. We see that parallel of visitation. We see an invitation to stay on Lot's part. We see a meal that he serves to them. And we see the intercession of Lot in a different way than we saw the intercession of Abraham. And we see different kinds of hospitality that are practiced. Consider Lot as opposed to Abraham. There are just a number of parallels. We're not going to bring all of them out today, but this is not an incidental aspect of storytelling. This is an intentional parallel that's drawn between the interaction with Abraham, who is a pilgrim, and the interaction with Lot, who we will see here is not acting as a pilgrim. He's made himself quite at home. If you remember back in chapter 18, verse 21, Adam did a good job there, I think, pointing out the fact that there's a judicial investigation that's going to go on. In verse 21, God had said, "I will go down to see," speaking of Sodom, "I will go down to see whether they've done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me, and if not, I will know." Now, this doesn't mean that God is not all-knowing, And he's got to go down and get out his magnifying glass and, you know, Sherlock Holmes cap on and see if he can figure out what's going on. But this is a judicial declaration. And one of the reasons why this episode here in chapter 19 is being revealed to us is to tell us that the outcry of their sin is indeed great. And this is a picture of God's verdict is guilty, and his judgment is about to be rendered. And again, as Adam mentioned in the last chapter, the very first verse here is an echo of verse 21. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening. This is in response to God saying, I will go down and see if they have done according to the outcry that has come to me. This is very similar to the language of the Tower of Babel, when God says, come, let us go down and confound their language, in response to their rebellious words, come, let us build ourselves a city up to heaven. God says, come, let's go down. So this is a rendering of just judgment by the angels, and it's by the Lord's command. And I think you see more of that in the book of Revelation and the judgment that's delivered, the angelic aspect of that judgment. And we're going to cover that when we actually look at the destruction of Sodom. But as they come to the city of Sodom, the first thing that's pointed out about the city is that Lot's sitting at the gate of the city. And I think there is significance to this posture and to this place. Again, there's another parallel here with Abraham, who lives in a tent. He doesn't live at the gate of the city. He's sitting in the door of his tent. Abraham's a pilgrim. He's not in love with this world. He's not invested in the cities of this earth. But Lot doesn't live in a tent. He lives in a house in Sodom. He's sitting at the city, or at the gate of the city, and he seems to be quite at home there. The significance of the gate is kind of a cross between a town hall and a town square. It's a public place. People would gather together there for all kinds of social interaction. And archaeological digs have found scenes of city gates where there'd be large stone benches where the leaders would sit, and people would come and bring matters that needed to be judged. And many of the legal documents that people find in archaeological digs from structures like this would close with words like, this was written after the proclamation at the entrance of the gate. Why is that important? Well, it tells us that it's not just incidental that, well, Lot just likes to live in town, because after all, it's a lot closer to Publix and, you know, the grocery store than living out in the country. But Lot's really invested himself here. He's a leader of some sort in this community. And he is, as one writer describes him, I forget who says this, but one writer called him a righteous man without the pilgrim spirit, a believer who walks by sight. So again, that's another comparison of Abraham and Lot. Another comparison, by the way, could be that in the beginning of chapter 18, the Lord comes to Abraham and he approves, and he eats a meal with him. And in chapter 19, you know, he visits Sodom, or his representatives visit Sodom, and judgment is the verdict. So the visitors want to stay at the city gate and just spend the night there in the square. And Lot, he knows the dangers of Sodom, and encourages them, get up early, get going, they thought. But he presses them very strongly, and the connotation there is he grabs them, basically, and says, we got to get out of here, and he begins to pull them toward his house. It reminds me of a time when I was visiting a church in a particular city that was known for its wickedness. And as night began to fall, the pastor said, we've got to get indoors. It's not a good idea to be outside here at night. And that's kind of the idea here. So they turn aside, verse 3, they enter his house, and he made them a feast of baked unleavened bread, and they ate. That's quite a bit different from the feast that Abram had made, his scurrying and the bountiful banquet that he provides. But Lot does show his hospitality, and it right away lets you know, these first three verses, this is an antithesis to what we saw in Abraham's response. But then in verses 4 through 10, we see the trouble. In verse 4, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. So the way this verse is written, it doesn't mean that every single person in the entire city surrounded the house, but this is a series, a literary device that's used to let you know that Sodom isn't just a town with a couple of bad gangs in it, or, you know, a couple hoodlums who are out of control. Now, the kind of behavior that we see at the door of Lot's house, surrounding the house, is the kind of behavior that is characteristic of the entire place. This is characteristic of the city. All the people to the last man, every section of the city, and it's to show the guilt of the entire city. And that guilt, of course, is outlined perhaps in Abraham's intercession in the previous chapter. Well, what if there's 10? Good. And the number keeps getting smaller, but the fact is the whole city, and there's no section of the city is excluded, no demographic to whom this doesn't apply, complete, utter moral culpability. Well, what's their problem here? What's the culpability? Verse 5, they called out to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." And no matter how many times I read this, I never cease to be amazed or disgusted. They wanted to commit homosexual gang rape. And one of the things that's astounded me is the picture here of the utter absence of any moral restraint whatsoever. These are people who could, and no doubt did, engage in the most lewd, immoral acts at random and at will. And whole groups of men who engaged in this kind of behavior on a regular basis, anytime they wanted to. And we have a tendency, perhaps, even in our own society, to think that, you know, sin is innocuous, it's neutral, let everybody do their own thing kind of thing. But the fact is, sin is not innocuous. It's progressive or digressive, you could say. We might think, well, couldn't they just kind of go their own way and do their own thing? But they could have one another, but they didn't. Mm. They wanted the strangers.
Yes. You know, Mark, it's interesting. That reminds me of and you point out the many parallels between the previous section in chapter 18 and here, especially this language of knowing. We talked about God in verse 19 choosing, or more literally translated, knowing Abraham, a language there which conveys friendship and fellowship and communion and giving, mutual giving to one another. Here, it's outside of the covenant. It's knowing in terms of exploiting others. It's brutality. Mm. It's ugly.
Yeah, that's another antithesis. Excellent that you point that out, the way of knowing, right? And I think that way of knowing, by the way, I think speaks to the nature of sin. And mm-hmm. And that's what I think this passage is showing us here. This is the antithesis to the friendship of God's covenant with his people, where he will pay the price for their sin. He's willing to lay down his life. And here, the nature of this knowing is they want to take life.
Yes.
And it's a voracious appetite and of immorality that is never appeased. And there's a lesson here for us. I'll get to at the end of this chapter a couple emphases, I think, that are in this chapter of sin, aggressively pursuing until everything's consumed and only death remains. Reminded of James chapter 1, when lust, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. Sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. And sin always, it's always on the move, the prowling beast that never rests until it conquers its prey, is always hunting, always moving. And what we see here at the Sodom and Gomorrah is the consequence of sin coming to full maturity. And what's even perhaps more astounding than that, we know that's the nature of sin. The wages of sin is death. Lust, when it's conceived, brings forth sin. When it's finished, it's death. What's astounding to me is this poison's affected Lot. What he does next is, at first, it seems to be commendable, and then it's criminal. he goes out to the men at the entrance in verse 6, and he shuts the door after him. So here's this mob surrounding his house, crying out, "Throw these guys out so we can have our way with them." And Lot acts courageously, and he has some respectability again in the community, but I still think is some act of courage, at one level at least. He goes out to the entrance, confronts the folks, he shuts the door after him, but even in confronting these people in their depravity, he reveals where he's invested himself. He calls these men his brothers. And there's another parallel, I think, here. Lot treats the three visitors, God himself, as we know, and then these two angelic messengers, as his own kin. He treats them as one of his own. He invites them in the most, he lays out a spread for them that speaks of far more than simply of wayfarers. And Lot considers the men of Sodom to be his brothers. He's one of them. And he appeals to them, don't act wickedly. Verse 7, he is concerned for his guests. But then in verse 8, he does what I think is unthinkable. He says to the men, and if any of you have children, particularly daughters, I don't even know how this would ever even cross his mind. It's unthinkable. Verse 8, behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. And I don't know if you can imagine doing something like this, but this is the place that sin puts Lot in. And I think there's a dual depravity, I think, in what Lot is doing here. First, offering his daughters. Secondly, he doesn't just offer his daughters to them. He baits the hook. You really want these girls because they're virgins. Wouldn't you like one of those? And, you know, you don't have any of those in this town, but I've got some. Here, you can have them. And, wow, I'm not sure what you say to that other than to say that Lot's put himself in the position where there is no good option for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think a very small point to Lot's credit is that his daughters are engaged to men from Sodom. Of course, that's not a good part. That's a problem in itself. But their engagement at least means that even these immoral men understood the nearly universal law of the ancient Near East, that if you have a sexual relationship with an engaged woman living in her father's house, then you get the death penalty. And I don't know, maybe Lot is trying to trap them in some sort of moral dilemma. Maybe, I don't know. That's the best spin I can put on it. Maybe he thinks, well, they would never do that. So maybe faced with this moral dilemma, they'll leave us alone. I'm not sure, but he's left hung out there. And I find it interesting, the angels only intervene when Lot's life is in danger. They force Lot to make this choice. They force Lot to see, I think, the utterly empty place where sin has led him. And I'll touch more on this as we close, and we talk about the emphasis of this chapter, but I think comes a time when even as believers, we can labor so heavily under the chains of sin that there are no more good solutions. Sin's done its work. The wages of sin have to be paid. The men of Sodom don't consider this to be a solution either in verse 9, but they reject that solution. They said, stand back. So now violence, I think, is pending here. Get out of the way or we'll move you. And they said, this fellow, and now they're speaking of Lot, they're talking to one another. This is kind of a rhetorical statement on their part. This fellow came to sojourn, this Lot. This guy's supposed to be a pilgrim. And that's, again, I don't think that's incidental because we learned in the previous chapter that Abraham sojourns. Lot is supposed to sojourn. And it's the people of Sodom who remind Lot that this guy's supposed to be sojourning. But he's become the judge. So now we're going to deal worse with you than with them. And they pressed hard against the man Lot, and they drew near to breaking down the door. So violence now, it says, which is the nature of sin? It's destructive, and violence soon follows. And again, I think the picture here is the degradation, the depravity of sin. Lot wants to uphold even the barest, we could say worst, minimal standard of decency, no matter how faint it is. And because of that, he's now the enemy. When the believer, when the Christian, when a church tries to make allies with the world, when it tries to form a treaty with the culture, then the alliance lasts as long as it's convenient for the world.
Good point.
You just look how quickly Lot's so-called, his brothers, they one minute were brothers, and the next minute they turn on him, they disown him, they call him this fellow. They don't return the compliment. So while the ignorant believer thinks that I can make these my brothers, the more properly informed by sin, unbeliever says, you're no brother of mine. This fellow, which is an insult, and they mock him for being a sojourner. And Lot took probably great pride in the fact that I sit in the gates of the city. So there's an irony, and I think we can see this in the church. We see this, I believe, frankly, in the church's, in much of the church's worship. We see it in the church's doctrine. We see it in an insufficient confidence in the means of grace, the preaching of God's word. We see that, ironically, the citizens of Sodom had a better understanding of Lot's position than Lot himself did. And I think in many cases, the world has a better understanding of what some aspects of the church are trying to do than the church itself does. Mm. They don't buy into it, and they don't buy into this either. They remind Lot of what he should have been, a pilgrim, something Lot should have remembered.
It's the antithesis that you bring out so well that exists between the city of God and the city of man, and we seek to make friendship with the world. You know, James says friendship with the world is to have God as your enemy. We forget how really the world doesn't really want to be our friends.
Right. We delude ourselves if we think that we can make friends, and by making friends, I don't mean in terms of showing love even to our enemies, but in terms right. of making allies.
Allies.
With right. those who are enemies of God. Yeah, that's a great point, Adam, because it points all the way back to Genesis 3, right? That aspect of enmity. God himself placed that enmity there. Mm-hmm. I will place enmity, God said.
Mm-hmm.
We show ourselves to be a lot like Lot if we think that we can circumvent that.
Yeah. We serve the world. We are kind to them. We pray for them. We treat them with kindness. But you're right. The idea comes out in allying with them and viewing them as brothers.
Right. What it takes for Lot to get out of this situation, of course, is he's backed up to the door. And what happens next is really nothing short of a miracle. In verses 10 and 11, the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out, groping for the door. And just to mention in passing here, the fact that even after they are struck with blindness, they're not going away. They're still groping for the door. Sin has already so blinded them that they've lost their senses. Their appetite is for sin only.
Mm.
And this is a supernatural invention. The word here has a connotation of a blinding light that strikes them. And the only other place this is used is in the story of Elisha, where the Lord strikes the Syrian army with blindness, and he saves Elisha. And here he saves Lot, and they're immobilized. In verse 12, we see the announcement that there is an impending judgment from verses 12 down to verse 17. We see a picture of that. The men say to Lot, "Have you anybody else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, anybody you have in the city, bring them out of this place." I want you to notice that the angel doesn't ask if these sons-in-law are professing Christians, just whether they're part of Lot's household. And as such, they'd be under God's covenant protection. There's some eligibility for rescue from this destruction, not ultimate eternal justification, but an eligibility under this covenantal friendship that God does have with Lot for his family. And again, that is a parallel picture that goes back, if you remember, to the episode in the last half of Genesis 18, where Abraham is told to take these truths and instruct his children. So the familial structure is still here. We see it as a repeat of what we see in Noah's Ark. Go into the Ark, you and your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. So because of the righteousness of Noah, his entire family is covered from the judgment of God. So in parallel with what God says to Abraham in chapter 18, it's worthy of our consideration here that his entire household is eligible to be saved from what? Verse 13, we're about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord. Remember, God had said, I'm going to go down and see if the outcry is great. And here, okay, we see. We came, we investigated, and indeed the outcry is great. Of course, God knew that beforehand. He sent us to destroy it. It's a statement of justness, of judicial rightness. God has acted justly. I have investigated. You are deserving of the death penalty. And so what we have in these verses up to verse 17 here and leading up to the actual judgment on Sodom is the beginning of the penalty phase. There's two points of emphasis that I'd like to mention. and appreciate your brother's input on other points of emphasis that maybe I've missed here. But the first point of emphasis is to ask, what do we make of this gang culture of sin? The violent homosexual rape that we see here. And I think the picture that we're looking at here is offered to us as a paradigm of ultimate evil. They will be, as we're going to see in the next section, Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be seen as the paradigm of ultimate judgment. It is a picture of the day of the Lord, the fire that's going to rain down upon them. And so this violent homosexual behavior is offered as a paradigm of ultimate depravity, anticipating and deserving of ultimate judgment. In Romans chapter 1, I think we see the consequences of idolatry, which encompasses all sin as the rejection of God, erasing the creator-creature distinction, worshiping the creature rather than the creator, making yourself the ultimate authority. And Romans says, claiming to be wise, they became fools. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals. And therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. And that's what we see in Sodom. It's the epitome of that. So the sin depicted here isn't just a sin, but it is a mark of judgment upon the sinner.
Yes. And here's the thing, of course, this is a charged question in our environment today where there's much discussion going on about homosexual relationships and marriages and of that nature. And so, I mean, we certainly have to get the full panoply of Scripture to speak on the issue. On the one hand, we know that as Paul informs the Corinthians, some of them were homosexual before they came to embrace the gospel. And so homosexuality is a sin that can receive forgiveness like other sins. And so that's good news for us. But on the other hand, there is something unique about this, and Romans really dusts that up in the sense that the idolatry that sin is involved in and God hands us over to further in sinful rebellion to idolatry can involve a distortion of the image of God. In the image of God, we are to relate to one another as male and female. And so I think there's a kind of heightened eschatological rebellion in homosexuality, and that it intends to throw over the creator-creature distinction at the base level of how we relate to one another as images of God. Maritally and sexually and so forth. And for that reason, you know, Paul speaks of exchanging the natural for that which is contrary to nature.
Right. The picture here of homosexuality is precisely the opposite of the redemptive, productive community of the family that's modeled after the very nature of the Trinity itself. The picture of the image of God, creator-creature distinction. And that's why I think that it degenerates into this, morality into immorality, rationality into irrationality.
Just one other thought on this Romans 1. We did some interviews with Marcus Menninger a while back on Christ the Center concerning his dissertation on Romans 1, 18 through 3, whatever verse it is in chapter 3. And I've also been preaching through Romans and recall this from the sermons I did on Romans 1 and 2. I think it's interesting that in Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about, in verse 18, the revelation of God's wrath. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And in chapter 1, as his thought unfolds, Paul is saying that God has revealed his wrath presently by giving them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. And so God giving them up or giving them over, which he says in chapter 1 three times, is the present revelation of God's wrath, which results in further descent into deeper depths of depravity.
Right.
And of course, that's what you're seeing, or we are seeing, when we're looking at Genesis 19 regarding Sodom. It's a paradigm of ultimate evil, which leads to a paradigm of judgment, of ultimate judgment. Mm. But something Marcus pointed out, I thought that was very, very helpful for me, is that in Romans chapter 2, Paul is talking to the person who is unlike those in chapter 1, who doesn't see God's wrath presently revealed, but nevertheless, even though God is being patient with him, which patience was designed to lead him to repentance, he's not repenting, and therefore he is storing up wrath for himself on the day of wrath when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. So the only reason I'm interjecting here and pointing this out is it is not always the case in history that humanity will keep descending into deeper depths of depravity immediately before the revelation of God's judgment. It could be that God's judgment is withheld and his wrath, instead of being presently revealed, is withheld until it is ultimately, consummatively revealed on the day of wrath. And so I would just want to be careful when we're drawing parallels between the generation of Lot and the last generation. I don't think it's necessarily the case that those two generations are going to be characterized by, you know, equal depths of depravity. That's not necessarily the case, even though, you know, Jesus, of course, uses the judgment on Sodom as a prefiguration for the final judgment at the end of the age, which I know is where you're going next.
Well, we'll certainly see that in the next section, yes. And it doesn't mean, as you mentioned, that it's always going to be apparent in the way that we expect it to be. And I think this is not a paradigm or prophetic idea of this is what it's going to look like at the end, mm-hmm. but this is what is deserving of God's judgment in the end.
Exactly. One of the reasons I wanted to point that out is just I grew up in dispensational circles. And I heard frequently the reference of, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah and how wicked it was back then, and how that's what it's going to be like immediately preceding the second coming of Christ, because Jesus said, as it was in the days of Sodom, so shall it also be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. But the parallel there is not necessarily with how wicked the people were, but with the wrath of God being poured out. And of course, you're going to explain that in more detail to us in a minute.
And how exactly it's going to look, we don't know. I do think, however, in my view, when we get to Revelation chapter 11, for example, and we see the picture of what the church will look like before Christ returns, that we do have some reason to think that sin will appear to have the victory, and yet it will not. And that's, again, another aspect of an antithesis in this chapter of what is apparent. Lot thinking you need to be saved from these wicked men, and the angels are saying, no, you need to be saved from the wrath of God. I think a second point of emphasis is that we should not think that what we see here in Sodom is more than just a few beats away from our own hearts. When we reject what we know of the truth, when we hold our own opinions and preferences and hobbies and activities above the commands of the Creator, then we too are worshiping the creature rather than the Creator. And we can read this chapter and cringe at their degeneracy, but we should never imagine that we can trifle with sin and not be infected with its fatal poison. And reminded of these angels urging Lot to leave, and then reading what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. In 1 Corinthians, flee those things that used to characterize you and instead pursue righteousness and godliness and faith. So, you know, as amazed as I am at Lot's actions, I'm sometimes amazed at Christians who've made so many poor choices that they've backed themselves into a corner and there's trouble all around them. And then they come to tell me what to do, Pastor. Solve this for me, but sins come home to roost. And I think the overarching point in the first section here is the utter helplessness and certain death outside of supernatural intervention. There's no compromise with sin. There's no loosening of its grip. And it takes a supernatural act of God to deliver us. And this act he delivers because of his compassion for us. And in the next section, we're going to see that Sodom is destroyed, But frankly, I think this first half is written for our encouragement. You say, well, it's not a very encouraging passage. Well, it ought to be if we candidly admit that our own faith and our own walk look hauntingly similar to that of Lot at times. And if that's the case, then I think it is for all who are not self-righteous that we may throw ourselves on the mercy of Christ, find mercy at the cross, where the judgment of God has rained down upon Christ, where Christ has swallowed up the judgment of God against sin. Because what happens when the fire falls upon Sodom and it's destroyed, it is the picture of what would happen to believers if Genesis 15 was never there, if God had not said, I will bear the curse on your behalf. And Lamentations 3 said, it is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. The last part of the sermon, I don't have time to deal with this now, but there's more that could be said of Christ's work, supernatural work of Christ and so on. But I think that the last part of the sermon, I think in terms of application, is to encourage God's people to think is, what is my response to this work? How will I respond to this love and this faithfulness and this compassion? There's a lot here, I think, for the people of God today to consider.
It's wonderful. Amen.
Well, thank you for listening to Proclaiming Christ, and I hope this passage and the previous one in Genesis makes you think about the fact that these stories of the Old Testament aren't just picture books to entertain us as we move toward the good stuff in the new, but rather they are pictures of the work of Jesus Christ, of the work of judgment that are filled out when we come to the New Testament. Appreciate also interacting with us today, Glenn Clary, pastor of Providence Presbyterian Church in Pflugerville, Texas, and Adam York, pastor of Providence Presbyterian Church in Kingwood, Texas. My name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee. And remember, we are a program of the Reformed Forum, reformforum.org, where you can find other excellent, not only other podcasts, but also articles and things of interest and help at reformforum.org/store. You can take a look at some of the things we offer there, including a recently published book by some of the folks at the Reform Forum. Thank you very much for listening to Proclaiming Christ.